This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday and time for the Week in Review, and we'll start today with news about brain injuries and football.
Aaron Hernandez had an advanced stage 3 of CTE, which is usually found in the median age of a 67-year-old man. It was the most severe case they had ever seen for someone of Aaron's age.
That was the announcement made yesterday by Jose Baez, lawyer for family members of the former Patriots tight end Hernandez, killed himself in prison while serving a life sentence for murder. This morning, Patriots coach Bill Belichick said this about his team's role in informing players of the dangers of CTE.
I'm not a doctor. I'm not a trainer. I'm a coach. So the medical department they handle the medical part of it. That I don't do that.
Now, the news about Hernandez's brain comes in the same week that Boston University researchers released a new study on what happens to the brains of people who played tackle football before the age of 12, and it's not good. Here's Dr. Robert Stern from BU's CTE Center.
Am I at a point to say kids shouldn't be hitting their heads repeatedly until a certain age? Yeah, I'm there. Doesn't it just make sense that we try to keep their brains from getting hit hundreds of times per season?
There's much to discuss, and joining us today is Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, it's good to see you again.
Same here.
Also with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Hi there, Tom.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, so I should say CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, that is the disease that Aaron Hernandez was posthumously diagnosed with, because you can't figure out who has it while people are alive. But Tom, let's just start with you. Give us your reaction to the fact that apparently, according to his lawyer, Aaron Hernandez had an advanced stage of the disease.
So, you know, the thing that jumps to mind here, of course, is that Aaron Hernandez had been convicted of murder and was in prison for life. And to be convicted of murder requires that you in some fashion be found culpable, mm-hmm. that you are responsible for your own behavior. And one of the implications of this, which I'm sure the NFL is going to vigorously dispute, is that potentially the CTE actually made it so that Hernandez was not responsible or in control of his own behaviors, and particularly because it appears that CTE really ends up affecting impulse control.
Yeah. Well, to that point, Hernandez's family's lawyer, just to remind folks, has filed a lawsuit on behalf of his daughter. And they claim in the lawsuit that the Patriots and the NFL were, quote, fully aware of the damage that could be inflicted from repetitive impact injuries to the head. Now, just today, though, the NFL told the Globe that they, of course, intend to contest that claim vigorously, and that Hernandez's, quote, well-documented behavioral issues began long before he played in the NFL. So that's going to be an ongoing battle there. I mean, Arlene, what's your take?
Well, you know, even before getting to the issue of the lawsuit, when you think about CTE, which, because I can't pronounce it quickly enough, I'm just going to call it CTE, the notion that a disease that can cause violent mood swings, impulse control, aggressiveness, depression, suicide, is so clearly now connected to repeated concussions or even less than concussions, is profound and frightening. And the fact that Hernandez had not just any old case, as though any old case would be bad enough, but he had a particularly severe one, that they said his 27-year-old brain looked as bad as a 67-year-old brain, is stunning. Mm. I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah, you know, so it's interesting because to get back to what you were saying, Tom, and actually also you, Arlene, we've had a lot of discussion and a lot of studies that link CTE to things like depression and other cognitive impacts. But this is the first case in which there was a crime was committed. And as Tom, you were saying, now the lawyers are asking, like, could this possibly have been a factor? Problem, of course, is you can't diagnose CTE while a person is alive. But to that note, I mean, Boston defense attorney Phil Tracy, not involved at all with the Hernandez case, but offered his legal analysis to Channel 4, CBS Boston, about the lawsuit against the NFL and the Patriots by Hernandez's lawyer. And here's what Phil Tracy had to say.
I don't see how they can prove it. Unless you had a smoking gun where somebody said, Aaron Hernandez's brain is cooked, and telling Belichick and Kraft and the staff, you don't have that. You know, that's not there. There's no way you can connect the dots, so to speak, to say that it's the NFL's fault or it's the Patriots' fault that he got CTE.
Tom, what's your take?
So, probably correct, okay? He only played for the NFL for 3 years. And he played football well prior to that, college, high school, mm-hmm. and so on. So all the NFL has to do is show that it could have happened in any of those other years and they're not responsible. But I don't think that's what this lawsuit's really about. The lawsuit isn't about the NFL. It's about football in general. And I think that's actually one of the things that's going to drive the NFL to eventually try to settle this case rather than have the trial painted across newspapers everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, you really think that they'll try to settle? Because I think the other thing that we've been hearing over the past several years is that the concern is with the cumulative effects, right, of these repeated hits. And Arlene, as you were saying, even the subconcussive impacts.
Well, that's what's particularly disturbing because as a parent of kids who were involved in sports, I always worried about concussions and never really thought through what now seems kind of obvious, that you don't have to reach as serious a condition as a concussion for it to be dangerous to the brain. And the notion that that the NFL might have known more than any of us did, that the notion that they may have concealed or misrepresented the risks of repeated traumatic impacts to NFL players is disgraceful.
Yeah.
Shame on them, because the only reason they'd be doing it, they may say they're doing it for the sport, they were doing it for the money.
You know what this is going to look like? It's going to look like the tobacco companies
fighting
the charges of cigarettes being dangerous.
Mm.
And they're going to do every trick in the book to try to make it so that the studies don't prove it. You don't have a certain length. It could be something else. And they will push and push and push until eventually, I think, the evidence will become overwhelming. And we're all going to look back and wonder, how on earth is we ever allowed this to happen?
Well, and interestingly, because I think the NFL now finds itself in a very, very difficult position that any other league that isn't as popular as the NFL would have a hard time recovering from. And that is that on the one hand, it can say, well, you know, it's not the NFL that's a problem, because there's all these other studies that point to the fact that, you know, early impacts on kids in Pop Warner, for example, can start leading to issues later in life. We'll talk about that study that just came out this week as well. But then again, they can't do that either, because no matter what, it's football as a whole that's getting maligned. And
exactly. And not only that, but the peak of football, which is the NFL, depends upon player development from a very early age.
Yes.
If the young kids don't get involved, then you really don't have the same quality product, if you will, that's going to be on the professional fields.
Yeah. So we talked to Dr. Robert Stern from Boston University, who was one of the lead authors of this other study that happened to also come out this week, earlier this week, where they looked at emotional regulation and cognitive function in folks in their 50s who had played football before the age of 12. And they found that those folks were 2 to 3 times more likely to suffer from difficulties in middle age. And I asked Dr. Stern, okay, so is it time for parents to stop letting their kids play tackle football? And he answered it in this way, that he had spoken to a former Super Bowl champion, didn't provide the person's name, and this player happens to have all daughters now. But Stern nevertheless asked him a question, and here's what he said.
If you had a son, or if you had a daughter that wanted to play, would you allow one of your kids to play youth tackle football? And here's someone who absolutely loved the game. He played 20 years of football. It was his life. And he very strongly and clearly answered, I don't know what all the answers are scientifically. We're not there yet. There's still so much to be done. So for me, the answer is delay it as much as possible.
And that's from, you know, secondhand, but it's from a former Super Bowl champ.
I can't believe Tom Brady said that.
Well, Tom Brady doesn't only have daughters, right? But
that speaks volumes. That tells you a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that Tom is right that, not Brady, but Keane, that people will look back in 10, 15 years, and not only will they be incredulous, but I think the children of some of these NFL folks are going to turn to their parents in 20 years and say, "What did you do, Dad? Why did you why didn't you say something? Why didn't you do something? Why did you let it go on and let all these people get
And hurt? Why did you let me play?"
Mm.
That's going to be the question. Why did you let me play knowing these dangers? I'm just a kid.
Yeah. You know, so here we are in eastern Massachusetts where, you know, maybe some kids have lots of different options for various team sports that they can and want to play. Of course, football still being very popular amongst those. But what I really wonder is how the cumulative effect of these studies and this news about football's impact on the brain, what effect that's having in places where football is basically like a religion, you know, in other parts of the country where it's almost indistinguishable from, you know, from the from regular school culture itself. Do you think that like that there are attitude changes there possible?
Yeah, I think it may be that people who are fans of Donald Trump, just nothing will change their mind, you know, and that's sort of like on football. There are people who are such fanatics for football that it's going to take an awful long time and a lot of evidence. And right now, they're going to believe the NFL and football advocates who say the evidence just isn't there. You know, we can make some minor changes and you don't have to worry about it.
There's a little bit of the money monkey, no see, no, you know, no hear, where whether it was dogfights that people now don't approve of because they know how cruel they are, or if we can hearken back several hundred thousand, whatever years to the fights in the Colosseum, you know, they were great entertainment, I'm sure, for the people who got to watch them. But we would never consider them today, right? Because you know things that are dangerous are just not appropriate to be entertained by. So if people want to choose to do it, so be it. But the NFL should be honest.
Well, so here's my pushback. Because a couple of years ago, I visited a high school and watched a high school football practice. And they spent a lot of time there being very careful about how the young men were tackling each other. Half the practice that I witnessed was all about adjusting tackle technique so that, you know, it wasn't head-to-head or even like just a full-on sort of battering ram. They were dropping shoulders. They were being very conscientious about teaching safer ways to tackle. And that's all the way, that's worked itself all the way down to, you know, the Pop Warner level, making a lot of changes there. Plus, folks say, there's disagreement about this, but some folks say the equipment is better too. So is it possible that those kinds of adjustments could make a positive difference so that the risks to the head are reduced?
So here's the pushback to that, and that is the subconcussive problem, which is that it definitely is possible, I think, to use equipment and technique to reduce the risk of concussion. And certainly now the concussion protocols are in place so that if someone does have the appearance of a concussion, you pull them out, you really make sure that they're fully recovered from the concussion before going back. But the really big problem here is the subconcussive stuff, where it's just the rocking back and forth of the brain very, very quickly within the skull that can cause this kind of damage. And if the evidence continues to show that it's subconcussive that causes the damage here, then I'm not sure how you solve that problem.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's move on, if we can, to other news of the week. This has to do with healthcare writ large across the nation, and that's specifically the Graham-Cassidy bill. It's the latest attempt by Senate Republicans to repeal and replace so-called Obamacare. Now, just today, Senator John McCain announced in a statement that, quote, he cannot in good conscience vote for the Graham-Cassidy proposal. So that brings the bill actually one step closer to perhaps a legislative failure. But earlier this week, Senator Lindsey Graham, whose name is on the bill of South Carolina, he said America faces a very stark choice with Graham-Cassidy, and the choice is this.
So here's the choice for America. Socialism or federalism when it comes to your health care?
Okay, Arlene, socialism or federalism? You decide.
Well, if Medicare is socialism, and it arguably is, then I'm all for socialism. So, you know, when Medicare was first created, the conservatives did in fact call it socialism and viewed it as the worst thing that could possibly be passed in Congress back then. Now people view it as untouchable, though some conservatives would like, in fact, to touch it. So this particular bill would cause so many massive cuts to health care. It would raise costs. It would reduce coverage. It would cut back protections for older Americans and people with pre-existing conditions. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how is the play?
I think Arlene's right that in fact, Medicare really is beloved now, which is exactly the reason that, you know, when Bernie Sanders now starts talking about a single-payer health care system, it's billed as Medicare for all, because that it's really just the idea, well, why not just extend it to more and more groups? But I think that the framing from Lindsey Graham is correct, which is that that is a version of socialism. Yes, it is. And what they're proposing, what the Republicans are proposing now, is basically federalism, to put block grants down, let the states do it as they will. Some states are going to win out of that, and other states are going to do really poorly out of it. And I think that's going to be the dynamic playing out politically here. Which states get gored, and do those states have Republicans in them? And if they do, maybe it doesn't pass.
Okay, so this idea that states can do it smarter is one that I asked Julie Rovner earlier this week. She's a longtime health policy reporter. And I said, you know, maybe there is something to that, because here we are in Massachusetts, a state that of its own accord before Obamacare decided to have reach for universal coverage, you know, so-called Romney Care. And she said, well, yeah, maybe states can be a laboratory. But then she reminded us kind of the essentials of what it took Massachusetts to actually get to that near universal coverage.
I was at a conference in Michigan with a bunch of state representatives and a bunch of visitors from Massachusetts, and Michigan was trying to figure out how they could, this was before the Affordable Care Act, but after Massachusetts, and trying to figure out how they did it. And the Massachusetts officials finally kind of looked down and said, well, you know, we had this big pot of money that Senator Kennedy helped us keep. And suddenly all the Michigan officials' sort of faces fell, because it's expensive to cover people with health care. Massachusetts did a very good job, but they also had the money to do it with.
I loved that story, because that is right there for me. That's the reality, that no matter what states try to do, if they really want to try and be bold, it requires assistance from the federal government.
You know, it's exactly right. You know, when I think about this issue, I think about that famous quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, where he said, taxes are the price we pay to live in a civilized society. Well, to me, health care coverage is the price we pay to live in a civilized society. If you want to live in a society that's as civilized as many industrialized nations in the world, you make sure that your people can have health insurance. Jimmy Kimmel had this wonderful tape segment this past week. I really encourage people to go on YouTube and look it up, because he really slammed the bill after having experienced a tremendously painful health problem with his newborn.
Well, we actually have a little bit of Jimmy Kimmel. He's been talking about it all week. This is from a Tuesday night monologue from his show, and here he is.
Most of the Congress people who vote on this bill probably won't even read it, and they want us to do the same thing. They want us to treat it like an iTunes service agreement. And this guy, Bill Cassidy, just lied right to my face. Do you believe that every American, regardless of income, should be able to get regular checkups, maternity care, et cetera, all of those things that people who have health care get and need?
Yep.
So yep is Washington for nope, I guess.
That's Jimmy Kimmel from earlier this week. I want to play one more piece of tape also here. This is Senator Graham again. This links back to something that you were saying, Tom, about who's going to get the money and who's not in the Graham-Cassidy bill. And basically, Senator Graham was saying if any of his colleagues vote against this legislation, they are voting, in his mind, for what is currently an unfair system.
You believe it's okay to help California, New York, Maryland, and Massachusetts more than Missouri. That's just what a Democrat would have to face if they voted no. If you're a Republican and you vote against federalism, you got to explain to people back home why Washington knows better.
Now, tell me why that isn't a potent argument in a lot of these states. I think it is.
It's a tremendously potent argument. I mean, the reality is that the states that took Obamacare and ran with it and expanded to coverage are now going to be losers under this. And yes, then the states that did nothing for their citizens would end up winning under the Graham-Cassidy bill. So yes, it's a politically very potent argument, and particularly because a lot of the states that expanded are mostly Democratic states. Mm-hmm. This clearly has elements of this us versus them in terms of the politics of this. The thing is, however, that some of the states that expanded also have Republican representatives.
Right.
And
right.
Those Republican representatives will be kind of looking at their constituents and saying, so do I really, you know, take money away from my state in favor of some larger national thing, or do I just decide to get reelected.
I know. And when you look at the details of the bill, I mean, even for those states that ostensibly win, everybody loses come 2027.
Exactly.
When
right.
the money just stops. It just goes away for the expansion money. And then there's that long-term permanent change to all of Medicaid, turning it into a per capita cap system versus sort of the open-ended payments that the federal government does now. Arlene, I just want to ask you also what you make of the politics of this moment, because we were discussing how Chuck Grassley earlier this week admitted he said to, you know, to reporters in Iowa, there's 10 reasons why this bill shouldn't even come to a vote. But because it was campaigned on so heavily, Republicans may feel the need to get something passed as a campaign promise.
Well, you know, there are some Republicans that don't believe there should be requirements to cover certain essential conditions, whether it's maternity care or mental health or substance abuse, prescription drugs, whatever it is. I disagree with them, but at least those people are honest, and I can respect their honesty. What I'm troubled with here is that so many of the Republicans are lying to the public and saying, oh, no, this will cover you, and they won't tell people the truth about how many
benefits
they'll
lose. Well,
they're
saying that states can come up with a way to have that covered everybody.
That's right. And if you believe that, I'd like to sell you a bridge.
The politics here are kind of incredible to me, because also a little earlier this week, there was this blip of news that saying in order to secure Lisa Murkowski's vote from Alaska, that Senate leadership was contemplating saying that Alaska could be exempt from the Medicaid cuts if at all that was to happen. So sort of vote against Obamacare by getting to keep Obamacare if you're Alaska. I mean, Tom?
No, it's tried and true politics, and it's done on both sides, quite frankly, in terms of making an exception, giving someone else some extra money. I suspect what will happen, though, is that, you know, John McCain's going to start asking the same for himself, and Susan Collins will be asking the same for Maine. And then if it ever gets through the Senate into the House, then you have to add in even more states to getting it. So who knows? Maybe ultimately this is just spending even more than Obamacare.
Yeah. You know, what continuously frustrates me about this whole process is that I think, you know, one place where everyone's in agreement, or most people are in agreement, Republicans and Democrats, is that there are key parts of Obamacare that do need fixing. We talk, you know, we're blue in the face about stabilizing the individual markets. But for some reason, even when there's a big area of overlap and agreement there, those are not the bills that we're seeing getting a serious push on Capitol Hill.
No, it goes back to the Grassley issue you raised, that certain Republicans say, well, gee, I said that I'd repeal Obamacare, so I have to do it. But the devil is in the details, and the details really matter.
Yeah, I have to say that I'm a little bit annoyed with the Democrats in this one, though, because part of the reason we're not having this bipartisan push is because a whole bunch of Democrats have now, in essence, come out against Obamacare by basically backing the Medicare for All proposal from Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and a whole host of others. And we're kind of taking our eye off the ball here by doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, I know a lot of listeners get mad at me when I say that, but they're also invested in not seeing President Trump be successful in anything. So any bill that gets passed that would put Trump's name on it, perhaps they're incented or have an incentive to not help a bill like that along. All right. Well, speaking of the president, Dotard?
I had to look it up, too.
I don't even know how to pronounce it. I mean, in the international nuclear weapon wielding name calling game, Kim Jong-un of North Korea has the latest hit here by calling President Donald Trump a dotard. But of course, earlier this week at the United Nations, President Trump had his own name for Kim Jong-un. So let's listen to that.
No nation on earth has an interest in seeing this band of criminals arm itself with nuclear weapons and missiles. The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
Arlene, I don't know whether to laugh or to cry, but I think I'm leaning towards tears these days.
Yeah, you know, I think his performance on the world stage was pretty embarrassing. I'm sure his base loved it, and he was clearly speaking to them. But the fact of the matter is, he wasn't speaking to them. He was speaking to the United Nations, and, you know, some of the other countries have criticized him. Sweden, I think it was, who said it was the wrong speech in the wrong time in the wrong audience. He was speaking like a middle school kid, saying, yeah, well, I'll beat you up if you try and beat me up. And it's just, that's fine in the middle school yard, maybe. It's not as fine in the United Nations.
But to Arlene's point, displays of strength are very, very important to Trump's base.
They are. I think it's probably the first time the General Assembly's ever been addressed by a Twitter storm. But it was a very, I've read through the entire speech. It was very disjointed. There were actually places that I liked it. And then all of a sudden it veers off into name calling and bluster. Yes, Donald Trump's base probably really likes this, but on the world stage, and I'm not sure that this really helps in getting us towards some sort of diplomatic solution.
Well, so speaking of diplomatic solutions, let me ask you both this. I mean, on the one hand, I feel like modern history is rife with politicians, having bellicose language, blustering, brinkmanship. But on the other hand, this feels weirdly different. I mean, I don't mean to focus too much on the name calling, but it's deeply, deeply disturbing that
it's immature
on both sides, and both sides have nuclear weapons. I mean,
yeah, you know, I've been watching this week on PBS Ken Burns' miniseries on Vietnam, and learning a lot or being reminded a lot of things that I'd forgotten. And what I'm remembering or learning for the first time is the myriad of mistakes that were made that both led up to the war and then continued it far longer than it could have. And all the people who now admit that they made mistakes, language and culture difference and not thinking about the way our opponents think, bad information, bad judgments. And I fear that while this is not yet analogous, we could be headed that way and then have it exacerbated by a schoolyard bully who doesn't realize when it's time to speak quietly and softly.
Two schoolyard bullies.
You're right.
To be honest.
You're right. One of whom you can't control in North Korea.
Yeah.
But you're stuck with him, and you better understand how he thinks, and you better understand how he approaches a problem, or you can make a calculated decision an uncalculated decision that's dead wrong.
Yeah. Tom?
I mean... North Korea, obviously, it's just a family issue, and we've had three generations, and they've kind of, you know, they have created this culture where name-calling is part and parcel of whom they are. It really shouldn't be the case for the United States, and I don't think it's probably, speak softly and carry a big stick has always been a better maxim, I think, than start yelling epithets at someone else.
Okay, I'm going to take a deep breath here. And try to put my despair aside. And should we end on a little high note, at least a little more enjoyable note with some hubbubs for this Friday? Okay, Arlene, you first.
All right, I got two quick hubbubs. The first one is to call people's attention to a Beacon Hill Times story about the 19th century church in Boston's Back Bay called the Church of the Covenant, which apparently has the largest intact collection of Tiffany stained glass church windows in the entire United States. They're currently in the process of restoring it, and I, for one, when their restoration is done, intend to go over there. And then maybe as a point of personal privilege, I'll add a Rosh Hashanah greeting, if I may. So for those listeners who don't celebrate this time of year as the New Year's, I'd like to wish you and your listeners a sweet new year of peace, health, and happiness.
Oh, it's wonderful. Your hubbub, Tom?
So here's a below-the-fold story that in years past used to be above the fold. Boston's having an election next Tuesday. Who knew? Well, there's a good reason you didn't know. Hardly anyone is running for office. There will be no ballot for the four at-large city council seats, and of the 9 district seats, only 4 have enough candidates to make for an election. True, there are four folks on the ballot for mayor, but only 2 of them, incumbent Marty Walsh and challenger city councilor Tito Jackson, are running serious campaigns. So turnout is undoubtedly going to be very low, and I'm sure we're going to all blame the voters for not being civic-minded enough to go to the polls. But really, to analogize politics to sports, why should fans show up if there are no players on the field?
Well, we have a clown running for city council.
Do we really?
We do, right?
A real clown?
Pat Payaso, right?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you don't think
there are some legendary
clown
clowns who did serve in the past, too.
Oh, God. All right. So my hubbub is, let me just take a survey amongst the two of you, my scientific, non-scientific survey of two. Do you like daylight savings time? Do you think we should stay on it? What do you think? Yes? No?
It gives us an excuse for being late from time once a year.
So I like the fact that we could do year-round daylight saving time, and I get how cool that would be, but we'd be completely out of sync with New York
exactly.
And every other media market I think it would disconnect us more from the rest of the country. Not in favor of it.
So just in case people don't know, there is a state commission, a panel that's looking into moving Massachusetts out of the Eastern Standard Time Zone and into what's known as Atlantic Standard Time. I kind of emotionally like the idea, but practically, I'm with you, Tom. Like, for 4 months out of the year, if you just wanted to call New York, you'd have to figure out what time it is right. in New York or New Hampshire or Vermont or anywhere.
That's right.
Which would be kind of weird. But one man's quixotic quest is how the Globe put it. I think that's a good way. But one man's quixotic quest in Massachusetts may end up actually being state policy.
Hard so we'll to believe.
See. I also, for the record, want everyone to know that my director, Jamie Bologna, loves this idea. He wants us to be on
Jamie.
Atlantic Standard Time. Well, on that note, it is currently 3:36. We're still on the Eastern Time Zone. Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Tom Keen, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Thanks so much, Tom.
You're welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.